Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Too much water being called a serious threat for Florida's springs. Environmentalists say the state's aquifers are like a bucket with holes where each spring flows.
When so much water comes out of there, or somebody sticks a straw in there and pumps the water out, then the level goes down below that hole, and then the spring becomes just nothing but a sinkhole.
Also this week, Central Florida doesn't have enough groundwater for its growing population, so planners are looking for alternatives.
We've been pumping groundwater in Florida for years and have come to realize over time that you just simply can't be continuously pumping groundwater.
We'll also check out Florida's water situation in a threatened lagoon and the biggest river basin in the northern part of the state. I'm Tom Flanagan, and welcome to a special Capitol Report on Florida's water. Before Disney World, SeaWorld, and Busch Gardens, visitors flocked to Florida for a different kind of tourist experience. But Regan McCarthy reports as the state's springs face pollution and overpumping, that legacy is fading along with the local economies that depend on it.
Each summer, visitors flood Wakulla Springs State Park to swim through the deep, cool water, spot the manatees, and watch the anhinga fish.
You could see everything crystal clear. The whole bottom was clear. All the plant life you could see floating, waving. Now it's covered in algae, so you know you don't really get to see any of that.
That's Lewis Poppelreiter. He and his family drove from Panama City Beach to come to the park because they heard the glass-bottom boat tour would be running, a rare occurrence lately.
A little bit more that's reminiscent of the old-school glass-bottom boat tour.
Poppelreiter says he has fond memories of the boat, so when he heard they'd be running again, he jumped at the chance for another ride. But he says it just wasn't the same.
It's very sad, and it's very sad what we saw out there with the amount of algae growth.
And Florida Spring Institute President Bob Knight says that, combined with decreased flows from people pumping too much water out of aquifers, is posing a serious threat to what he calls the first tourist attraction of Florida, springs.
So when you reduce flow in a river, you reduce the productivity of everything in it. Reduce the ability of the river to support recreation and aesthetic properties.
Knight says under state law, there's supposed to be a limit on how much water people can pump out of the underground aquifers and rivers. They're called minimum flow standards.
If you have anything less than this minimum flow, this river does not pass muster, and it needs to be fixed. It's sort of a bad target. It'd be much better to set adequate flows and the reserve flow for these rivers.
And in addition to setting those minimum flow standards, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection is also working on setting limits for nutrients in the water. Deputy Director for Water Policy and Ecosystem Restoration, Drew Bartlett, says his department is working with farmers to help them use water more efficiently.
You can, you know, stand there like you do in your yard with a hose and just spray in the hose. Or you could lay down a soaker hose that drips water, you know, at the roots, and it gets it right to the roots. You're not putting excess water out there that the plants aren't even taking advantage of.
But Bob Knight with the Spring Institute says some of those efforts are hurting more than they're helping. On the road to Ginny Springs, he points out one such farm.
They're losing, I would estimate, somewhere between 50 and 70% of the fertilizer, in spite of that, into the ground. And that's heading straight for Ginny Springs and the Ginny Springs group. This is, I mean, the reality. It's right in front of your face.
Knight says the farmer is pumping water straight out of the underground aquifer. And the fertilizer Knight's talking about is one of the biggest culprits for the nitrogen that's causing pollution and algae growth in many springs. Ginny Springs owner Mark Ray says he's worried about the herbicides that could be coming into his springs, too. Ray says his water used to be crystal clear. The bottom was covered in eelgrass with a sugar-white sand path down the middle.
It's still very beautiful, but what's missing is all the plant life is gone. And I say basically, that would pretty much be all. And what has it taken its place is all this green algae and brown algae that you see on the bottom. We need the grasses for the turtles to eat. I mean, that's literally their meal for a lot of turtles. We need it for the fish. We need it for all the other little organisms.
Ray suspects the loss of vegetation is probably linked with the use of herbicides in nearby fields. But Tom Frick, the director of the DEP's Environmental Assessment and Restoration Division, says he doesn't think the concentration of herbicides in the water is a big problem.
Because there's literally hundreds of, you know, millions of gallons that are coming out, you know, daily out of these systems.
Meanwhile, Altamont Springs Republican Senator David Simmons is working with a group of lawmakers to draft a bill for the coming session that would put standards and timelines in place for protection and restoration efforts that have sometimes been sluggish.
We're trying to come up with a feasible, reasonable solution.
Meanwhile, Knight says he hopes Simmons' bill gets serious consideration, but he worries about the impact a pushback from big industries like utilities and agriculture could have.
Everything's so taboo nowadays, there's always some interest group against you.
But Knight says even though sometimes he feels like Don Quixote tilting at windmills, he's not giving up. He says eventually he has to win. He has the high ground. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Central Florida planners are grappling with a challenge. There's not enough water for the people expected to live in the area 20 years from now. As Jessica Palumbo reports, that realization has prompted unprecedented collaboration between local governments, private utilities, and state agencies as they search for more water.
In an October committee meeting, Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam gave lawmakers an alarming-sounding statistic about water in Central Florida.
In the next 20 years, they've got to find another 200 million gallons per day to support a high quality of life.
As the Orlando area population is projected to rise by more than 50%, there's just not enough water in the state's primary source, the underground Floridan aquifer. The actual projected shortage is closer to 255 million gallons per day. That's enough drinking and bathing water for about 50 small cities.
We need to look at other options than just fresh groundwater.
That's St. John's River Water Management District engineer Tom Bartol. He's part of a group called the Central Florida Water Initiative.
What it is a collaborative effort for the first time that we have got all of these agencies, organizations, and water suppliers and utilities working together on these issues.
The initiative is taking public comment on a first draft of a water supply plan. When it's adopted next year, the plan won't be a binding document, but Bartol says it's a tool utilities can use to plan regionally rather than just hyper-locally. That's already happening in the city of Altamont Springs. Public Works Director Ed Torres is looking at a map of Apopka, a city whose population is expected to at least double, maybe triple, within 20 years.
We are building a 5-mile-long pipe to the city of Apopka, so we can deliver to them any excess reclaimed water that we have available.
In addition to the new pipeline, Torres and his team are planning one of the state's first plants for reclaiming stormwater. He says both projects will keep polluted water out of rivers and will generate 4.5 million gallons of water every day.
So that goes a long way. I mean, 4.5 MGD is what a small city could use potable water for the entire city. Again, as opposed to wasting that water.
And with new development planned across the region, Torres says there's no choice but to find substitutes for groundwater.
Again, the alternatives are losing our wetlands and our springs and everything that we learned to love in this state, or having a moratorium for construction. Mm-hmm. Both are unacceptable.
The draft water supply plan says the priority must be on minimizing water use. But Seminole County Environmental Services Director Andy Neff says conservation only goes so far.
The cost of water is going to go up. You know, as water becomes more constrained and more valuable to us.
He says Florida is blessed with high-quality underground water. But using alternatives like reclaimed water, river water, and ocean water is costly. And he says customers will notice bigger bills. Here in Sanford, Neff is driving through the gate at the Yankee Lake Wastewater Treatment Plant.
It's the first facility in the region that is ready to go to provide a regional source of water.
The Yankee Lake plant pumps up to 50 million gallons of water every day from the St. John's River and purifies it for irrigation. Yankee Lake's construction took more than a decade from planning to first pump. 2 years and $2 million of its $55 million price tag were spent defending its pumping permits against challenges from North Florida groups worried the pumping would affect the river downstream.
This certainly was a reasonable and beneficial use and, you know, would not impact other legal users. And certainly was in the public interest.
Those same groups might be up for another fight as the draft water supply plan suggests more sites where water can be pumped from the St. John's and other rivers. Neff says the next phase for the water initiative is to start planning for specific projects and looking for the state and federal funding to build them. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. Still to come on Capitol Report, as research scientists try to find the source of a massive animal die-off in the Indian River Lagoon, it's starting to look more like a murder mystery.
And the challenges for doing forensics in human murder cases, and the challenges we have in doing animal field investigations are all very similar in a way.
An explosion of toxic algae growth in many Florida water bodies is being blamed on Central Florida pollution.
Over 60% of the nitrogen loading that is in the river here in Jacksonville is from upstream.
And we'll get the latest on the long-running interstate battle over the Apalachicola River Basin.
To know the river is to love the river.
Finding out the source of a mysterious animal die-off in the Indian River Lagoon is the goal of many researchers and scientists across the state. As Sasha Cordner reports, they're searching for clues into the massive amount of unusual deaths of manatees, dolphins, and pelicans in what's known as one of the nation's most biologically diverse estuaries.
I think they're mating. I think he's chasing her down and trying to mate.
As I take a tour of the southern part of the Indian River Lagoon, its riverkeeper, Marty Baum, points out a small pod of dolphins frolicking in one part of the 156-mile estuary. The water, starting to clear up after temporary relief from polluted discharges, is now a blue color, not so about a month ago. But it's over on the other side of the lagoon, the northern part, that has scientists truly worried. That area, oftentimes called a hot spot, is the site of a massive die-off of pelicans, manatees, and dolphins. And right now, no one really knows why. Some even call it, quote, a challenging form of CSI or crime scene investigation. Okay, so maybe not like CSI Miami, more like CSI Indian River Lagoon. The phrase is coined by Jan Landsberg, the state's lead investigator into all mysterious animal deaths. She says what researchers are trying to work out is the common thread linking the three species.
I suppose it is like a murder mystery, and like there's a, you know, someone was running from the scene, and well, they're obviously the culprit when they're not, but it might be easy to assume that because you've got all this. So in a way, you could say, you know, perhaps at the beginning, the macroalgae was the obvious thing, but maybe it's not, because there's other things that start to become obvious.
Landsberg is also a research scientist for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and she's referring to algae blooms that have been plaguing the lagoon and have destroyed thousands of acres of seagrass, which all three species depend on in their own way.
And because the seagrass died, we don't know what the direct effects are or indirect effects are, but it certainly is like everything happened after that. So we have to naturally assume that it's connected somehow.
That's Megan Stolen, a research biologist with the Hub SeaWorld Research Institute in Melbourne Beach. Stolen's expertise is dolphins and whales, and she and her fellow researchers have been looking into the more than 50 dolphin deaths in the Indian River Lagoon earlier this year, which she says has been particularly bad.
You shouldn't see a dolphin with a neck.
You know, they should be torpedo-shaped. I mean, they should just be plump and like round like a torpedo. Anything less than that means that they're either skinny or pretty emaciated.
The only bright spot was one bottlenose dolphin who survived and has since been released and is still under monitoring by her institute. As for the manatees, this year became the deadliest year for the Florida's endangered sea cows. Close to 800 have died, surpassing the 2010 record by about 20. 111 of those were from the Indian River Lagoon alone. And Dr. Brian LaPointe of the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute in Fort Pierce says, from examining the digestive tracts of manatees who normally eat seagrass, the offender appears to be a red drift seaweed called Gracilaria.
And this plant is Gracilaria. It grows naturally in the Indian River Lagoon, but because of all the nutrients from septic tanks, fertilizer runoff, and the various human sources on the watershed, this plant has formed massive blooms. It overgrows seagrasses, and it can smother the seagrasses, cutting off the light that they need, for example. And this has affected, of course, the manatee.
Meanwhile, it's the pelicans that saw the worst of it in the mysterious die-off. An estimated 300 of them died in the Indian River Lagoon. And Martin County Commissioner Sarah Hurd may have a theory. She says perhaps even for the pelicans, it could be as simple as not seeing any fish in the very opaque water.
Because they, of course, are completely reliant upon being able to dive bomb fish and scoop them up. So if you can't see through the water, you can't fish.
But to find those answers and to continue searching for clues, it comes down to money. Some researchers are hoping for federal grants. Others may find relief in Congress's WERDA bill or the Water Resources Reform and Development Act, while others hope for state money. State lawmakers, for example, this year appropriated $2 million for the Harbor Oceanographic Institute to continue its Indian River Lagoon research. Last year, they did the same for a similar venture, but it was vetoed by Governor Rick Scott. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Too much water can be as harmful as too little water. What happens when it rains for more than a month? In central Florida back in July, it meant an overflowing Lake Okeechobee and the dumping of millions of gallons of polluted runoff into the region's rivers and estuaries. As Lynn Hatter reports, the rain also sparked the growth of toxic algae blooms that have some asking state lawmakers to fund a $200 million water conservation and cleanup plan.
It's a little bit different flavor for every estuary and every system in South Florida, including the Everglades.
Stephen Davis is a scientist with the Everglades Foundation. His office sits in the former headquarters of Burger King, overlooking the clear waters of Miami's Biscayne Bay. Earlier in the year, those pristine waters looked more like a green cesspool, and they smelled equally as bad. The Florida Department of Health put up advisory notices telling people to stay away. The cause of the algae bloom that enveloped the bay, described as one of the worst the waterway has seen, is still unknown. Davis says the answer could lie with Central Florida's Lake Okeechobee and the network of canals and dams that run throughout Central and South Florida in order to make the area habitable for humans.
We're discharging large volumes of water down the Caloosahatchee in St. Lucie. That water is polluted, so that creates two problems. One, it's too much fresh water for those estuaries, but it's also too much polluted water as well that leads to algae blooms. But in the Everglades, it's a lack of fresh water, and what fresh water it does receive is polluted.
Many of the water bodies that saw the worst algae blooms this summer originate at a single source, Lake Okeechobee. The Caloosahatchee and St. Lucie rivers run to the east and west of the lake. Both saw algae blooms. And the St. Johns River, which flows north from Lake O to Jacksonville, also experienced a bloom so toxic the Florida Department of Health issued advisories.
You said it's all streaked out behind NAS Jacks.
With no wind this morning, the current's going to pile it up more than
Even today, there are signs of algae spotting the St. Johns River. While touring the river with St. Johns Riverkeeper Lisa Renneman, we see a man walk off his dock and dump something into the water. Renneman says humans, or more importantly, human waste, are a big part of what's ailing the St. Johns.
That waste comes from some 16,000 septic tanks along the riverbanks, many which are failing.
And that's been a major issue that we're actually not happy with the city of Jacksonville right now, because they're diverting millions and millions of dollars away from phasing out septic tanks on our waterways to actually buying water quality trading credits.
Much of the pollution reduction work in Duval County has fallen to the county's waste management program called JEA. The utility has met and surpassed its reduction goals, allowing it to sell credits to other groups trying to do the same. The city of Jacksonville has purchased some of those credits to count toward its goals. It's also trying to get rid of those failing septic tanks along the river. But decreasing the amount of pollution in the St. Johns, says City of Jacksonville Director of Public Works Jim Robinson, isn't just a matter of cleaning up the nearby water.
Over 60% of the nitrogen loading that is in the river here in Jacksonville is from upstream.
Because the river flows north.
That's right. We start with 60% bad when it gets here. And so it very much is more than just a local issue. It's a state issue.
The St. Johns River got lucky this year, although luck in this case is relative. Unlike previous years, there were no massive animal die-offs from the algae. However, that's not the case for Central Florida's Indian River Lagoon, an offshoot of the St. Lucie River.
100% of them. All of them died.
Florida Oceanographic Society scientist Vincent Encomio says all of the St. Lucie River oysters have died. And this summer's algae blooms were a big, big problem, says Society spokeswoman Megan Roberts.
The water had been deemed toxic by the Martin County Health Department for 5 months. People were experiencing rashes and sickness, kind of like flu, lung irritation, things like that.
Society researchers are now trying to rebuild the decimated oyster beds by collecting shells from nearby seafood restaurants. The causes of excess phosphorus and nitrogen in the water bodies vary, but the summer of 2014 was bad enough to catch lawmakers' attention. Among them, Republican Senator Joe Negron, whose home district is in Stewart. In November, the senator unveiled a $220 million list of projects, including asking the federal government to give Florida control of the Lake Okeechobee discharges and restoring natural water flow routes through Central and South Florida.
You know, my message to the Treasure Coast in Southwest Florida is that more help is on the way.
But that plan will have to compete with others for funding. And by the March start of the 2014 legislative session, Florida's 2013 summer woes will be nearly a year old and may not be top of the mind for the lawmakers Negron hopes will wake up and smell the oysters. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Our look at Florida's water winds up in the state's panhandle. Last summer, politicians and citizens crowded a U.S. Senate panel hearing in Apalachicola. They were demanding action on the dwindling water flows from Georgia to the Apalachicola River Basin. But as Ryan Bank reports, some river enthusiasts say Florida's focus on the lack of water from its northern neighbor is narrow and short-sighted.
After a debilitating drought in 2012 that almost collapsed North Florida's oyster industry, U.S. Senators Marco Rubio and Bill Nelson, U.S. Representative Steve Sutherland, and Florida Governor Rick Scott seemed certain who was to blame.
Georgia has taken our water.
Primary cause of the disaster, a lack of fresh water.
I have seen firsthand the devastating impact of reduced downstream flows on this community's ecosystem, environment, and economy.
By decisions being made by men, not by nature, not by some other change in the economy, but by a simple decision being made by another state is just heartbreaking.
In what was just the latest battle in the so-called water wars between Florida, Alabama, and Georgia, Florida politicians on both sides of the political divide were quick to blame the drought and ensuing chaos in Apalachicola Bay's oyster industry on excess water usage by the Metro Atlanta area. But not everyone is quick to point fingers at the Sunshine State's northern neighbor.
All you have to do is lift him up. I wouldn't, Earl, but you can if you want to.
In late November, Earl Moreau, David Monahan, and Chris Smith embarked on a five-day, 100-mile journey along the entire length of the Apalachicola River. The three modern-day explorers built a barge using six large barrels, some wooden planks, and a small outboard motor powered by a large solar panel. Monahan, an award-winning nature photographer, mounted a camera atop the vessel, and the team set out to photograph every piece of the ancient waterway in the hopes they'd inspire its conservation. Monahan hopes the project gives people a sense of urgency.
It's all gradually degrading, and with the shifting baseline, it's kind of hard to see it all happen. You know, you don't see it as a big jump.
The cause of Apalachicola's environmental crisis is complicated and stems from a number of factors, including industrial farming, climate change, man-made dams and estuaries, and Atlanta's water consumption. Earl Moreau, the River Expedition's director, says the approach Rick Scott took, suing Georgia in federal court in September, is simplistic and unfair.
I think a reason for a lot of the conflict is ultimately that it's what's happening is seen as inequitable, and sometimes unfairly so. People or cities or farmers are being kind of unfairly accused of sucking up all the water. And actually, I think it's a more complex problem than that.
Moreau is no stranger to the river. He's kayaked the waterway numerous times, including a solo trip in 2009 to celebrate his 60th birthday. While working for the Apalachicola River Keeper, he met Steve Lightman, a conservationist who's worked with the river for more than 40 years. Lightman says the term water war is wholly inaccurate.
And so if you framed it as that it's the difference between these interests and how do we deal with their needs rather than what the three states want, then you start realizing that it's not everyone in Georgia on one team, everyone in Alabama on one team, and everyone in Florida on one team, but it's different interests in different states, sometimes they're on the same side.
Lightman says the real divisions are between farmers, city-dwelling consumers, fishermen, and conservationists, and he says there's enough blame to go around. Lightman says the broader problem comes from the presumption that water is an infinite resource and that climate is unchanging.
The low flows in the Flint made it where that there was a multi-year drought, and it's like I said before, is that we expect to have favorable climate forever, and it's not the most real expectation.
There's no word on the status of Florida's lawsuit against Georgia, whose Governor Nathan Deal has scoffed at the idea that his state is to blame for Apalachicola's water woes. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Bank, Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment, on the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.